Hello. Before we begin, I'd like to take a moment to point out the letters and the numbers for those of you who are keeping track of your continuing education credits. The sign number is 5 and the sign letter is E. Also, if you need assistance during this lecture, please do not hesitate to call upon myself or Betsy. For those individuals who are earning CEU credits, please look through your CEU evaluation form and fill it in at the close of session. We are grateful to TIC, the Talking Information Center Network, who is recording some of our sessions today, including this one. Please know that a voice recording this session and a copy of the PowerPoint will be available on the Focus website in the Focus Conference archives. The web address can be found on the black and white business card on your yellow folder, Vision on Vision and visionloss.org. We are grateful to Dr. Han and Dr. Reuter for sharing their work in this way with us for your continued learning. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Han, Doctor of Optometry, Assistant Professor, and Dr. Reuter, Doctor of Optometry, Assistant Professor, Mass College of Pharmacy and Health Science, School of Optometry. We are so appreciative of Dr. Han and Dr. Reuter collaboration efforts for this presentation. Dr. Han and Dr. Reuter will be presenting binocular vision dysfunctions, diagnosis and treatment in those with developmental disabilities. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Han and Dr. Reuter.
Or is there a difference? Kind of?
Yeah.
Is that better? Is the microphone better? Okay. So I will click this on myself. And I have a loud voice, so if any time it's too much, just raise a hand. Can you still hear me? Can you hear me back there? These are nice microphones. I can't tell that I'm amplified. It's great. So I'm not sure of all the different levels that we have in the room. If at any time we're talking about something that you want more information on, just raise your hand and say, can you explain that more or not, just because I don't know everybody's different role in the visual world, okay? We're going to talk about binocular vision dysfunctions. That might, to some of you, sound familiar. Other people, that might sound odd. Binocular vision just means how we're using both of our eyes together, so a two-eyed system. Many, many skills go into using both eyes together, and we're going to talk about that today. So our goal is to talk about vision and what it is and how it works, what comprises a healthy visual system on a structural and a functional level, what happens during an eye exam, what happens during a developmental disability evaluation, how to identify a functional issue in a patient, and how to treat that dysfunction. Either through glasses. There's a various types of lenses that we can use and vision therapy. How many in the room have ever heard of vision therapy? Great, this is good. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about vision therapy at the end, and please ask as many questions as you would like. So I'd like to start out with some stats. You guys, many of you have heard of vision therapy, which is helpful. A lot of people haven't. And so it's really important because we, so many times, even in our own profession, I think people equate vision with sight, and we'll talk about the differences in a second. And so people think that a vision dysfunction is just an inability to see 20/20, which we'll find out that's not true. So if we're just talking about a clarity, from a clarity perspective, people don't realize that there's just so much more to that. And so I'd like to start with stats. So 1 out of 4, so 25% of students have visual problems that are serious enough to impede learning. That isn't the need for glasses. This is a different function, like the functional visual system, and we'll get into it. So 1 out of 4. So if you have a kid, a class of 25 kids or a class of 20 kids, you've got 4 kids or five kids in there that have a vision problem that could impede their learning. 6 out of 10 children with a learning disability have undiagnosed vision problems. So now we're up to 60%. And then the next one is 7 out of 10. So now we're up to 70% of children with learning disabilities have issues with visual perception. Okay, so it's really important to identify this and to help these kids or these patients where we can. I do want to say from the beginning that we're not here saying that we erase the disability. That's not at all what vision therapy is about. We're here to help the organism, the patient, adapt around that disability. So help them use their eyes better so that they don't have to think so hard to use their eyes. It frees up more attention, more neurological capabilities for them to attend to other things in their life and in their world. So the myth that 20/20 means perfect vision, all 20/20 means is that we can see a very small object from 20 feet. The 20 number is just from 20 feet, and the other 20 is just the size of a letter. Or the size of an object, but we always use letters. It doesn't talk about what the brain does with that information. It doesn't talk about the other skills needed in order to see efficiently. It doesn't talk about whether the object is moving or not. And I think for most of us, we could say, how often are we ever sitting down still, looking at a very small still object? Really almost never, okay? So that's all that 20/20 means. And sadly, in our society, that's really all that's measured, even in most of our profession and our colleagues. Mm-hmm. We go and we look at structure, right? Is the eye healthy? Which is very, very important. But the only functional test a lot of eye doctors, ophthalmology or optometry, do is visual acuity. And so there's at least 18 other skills that are necessary for a functional diagnosis, and we'll get into those in a second. So like I said, this is a measure of a sharpness of sight. It doesn't tell you anything about how the brain is processing that information. It doesn't even tell you if the information is getting properly to the brain. So one thing I always like to point out, I am the professor for the neuro-optometry course, so I'm going to talk about neurology a lot. Vision, you cannot talk about the eye or vision without talking about the brain. So vision happens in the brain. So I always like to point out the neurology around this. So 65% of the brain's pathways are involved in the visual process. So that's a ton. And of that 65%, only a very, very small percentage is involved in the 20/20 capability. So it tells you where our neurology is dedicated. It's not dedicated so much to the 20/20. One more thing I want to say about the neurology. There's so much that I could say about this, but the whole brain is involved in the visual process, every single lobe. So if there is something going on in the brain, there's a very, very good chance there is something going on with the visual system. So when you talk about somebody with a disability, often we're talking about a neurological disability or a person who's had a traumatic brain injury or anything like that, I can almost guarantee you there's going to be a functional vision problem. And if you go to a person who's astute enough to pick it up, it can really help the person function if it's fixed. So this is just an edification about sight versus vision. Has anybody ever seen this picture before? Okay, so is it blurry to anybody? It's blurry? Right, but it's not decodable. But it's not blurry, right? So we can see the lines, and we can see the contrast, we can see everything, but we don't know what it is. And this is the point of vision. It's like if you're 20/20 and the information is getting there clearly, but your brain doesn't know how to interpret that information, who cares, really, at the end of the day? So this is a cow. How many people can pick that up? Here's his face and his little nostrils, ears.
I was thinking skull.
Kind of. He's got a skull, you know. The next picture shows you.
Yeah, that's like the outline of it.
So now go back to the slide before. And now how many people can see what it is? Are people still having issues? Can't see the cow. Go back to the next slide. Do you see the cow in the left side?
Yeah.
Okay, and can you flip it over and see the face and the ears on this guy? Eye, ears, face. Takes a while.
Yeah.
Once you get it, though, you have context for it, and you will no longer ever not see it again.
Okay, because your brain is pulling on previous experience, is pulling on what it already knows, what it has dealt with before, and now you're equipped to look at this picture and know what it is. This is the same thing that happens with visual processing every single day, all throughout our lives. If we don't understand what we're seeing, we're not going to see, even if we're 20/20. Okay? So a better definition of vision, besides this whole 20/20 thing that we're used to hearing, is that vision is a dynamic process. We use it to identify, to organize, and to interpret what we see. But then we have to do something about that, right? So like if the information gets in and we interpret it correctly, now what? What do? We have to formulate an action or formulate a non-reaction, right? So many of us have to decide to not respond, right? So that's inhibition, and that's a response in and of itself. So vision has to get to the brain, we have to interpret it correctly, and then we have to figure out what it means and do something about it. That's the visual process, and that is in the brain. Starts in the eye, ends up in the brain. Do you want to take it? Is this your slide? I forgot where we're switching.
Sure, I can take it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so next we're going to talk about vision development. So kind of like Dr. Reuter already said, vision is part of the brain. So I think of vision as being a circuit or being part of a larger circuit. So when a child is first born, that circuit is going to be new. It hasn't experienced all the different sensory as well as motor components yet. So this child, the firstborn child, or when the child is first born, their system is very malleable. So they can be easily changed based on the different type of sensory or new experiences that they are going to experience. So there's a couple different critical stages for a child's vision to develop. And most dramatically from the 6 to the 12 months period. And this is why we recommend every child to have their eye examined during this time. Because if there's any type of disturbance that happens during this time, it's going to affect the child's visual potential significantly down the line. Yeah, sure. And so vision occurs, a lot of learning occurs visually. So when the child first opens their eyes, they're going to be looking at their parents' faces, learning how to recognize facial expressions, and to, you know, classroom setting when they're learning objects, shapes, colors, etc. So if there's any type of visual skill deficiency, it's going to impact the child's academic as well as their athletic performances. I'm not saying that it's impossible for the child to perform well. It's just that it's going to be a hurdle for these child to be even to gather the visual information and then to effectively process everything. So the child's going to have to work a lot harder to achieve their potential. And oftentimes, you know, when the child has to work hard, and they don't have the motivation, they're just going to give up, and they don't perform as well as they could be. So,
Want to mention there, most kids don't know that that's an issue because of how they've always seen. And so they don't think to say, hey, mom and dad, this is uncomfortable when I'm looking at this. This goes in and out of clarity. This is wavy when I look at it. I see two of something. They just think that everybody sees the way they see it and that they're not a good learner until they give up and they usually early on get labeled, you know, and you hear parents, like, oh, my kid's not a school kid. The brain is there to acquire information. So that's pretty much what we're, like, put here to do, is learn. And so if I hear a parent say, my child's just, they don't like reading or they're not into that, I really am, that's a symptom. Avoidance is a symptom.
Yeah.
So that just to speak to what you're saying, they don't know.
They don't complain about anything, pretty much,
right.
Usually. And so here are some of the visual skills that we've listed, and we'll talk about each one of them in detail next. So during a comprehensive eye exam, we're going to be looking at all of these different areas, and we'll talk about them next. All of these areas are also looked at during our developmental disability evaluation with some modifications to how we're going to perform these tests. And this is a little different as well from a vision screening, which, you know, usually evaluates based on a failing or a passing result, and it doesn't really treat or diagnose any specific issues. So
I don't know when you want me to.
Oh, yeah, sure. So next we're going to talk about visual acuity. So like Dr. Reuter said earlier, this is the ability to resolve those details to see the smallest letter possible. So for a normal individual, when they go see an eye doctor, we have them read the smallest letter that they can resolve. And this is not a very easy task, because not only do you have to be able to resolve the details of that letter, but you have to be able to recognize it from the 26 choices that you have, also and also to articulate that information back to the doctor. So if the patient cannot, you know, recognize or articulate the information, then we cannot measure visual acuity using those letters. Alternatively, we can use a layer of symbols, which only has four options. So there's the square, the house, the circle, and the heart. We have the patient call it whatever they want to. So they can call it a triangle, they can call it a barn, as long as they're consistent with what name, how they're going to name it. If the patient is nonverbal, so if they cannot report anything back to us, we can use something known as matching. So we give them a matching card and has all the four shapes on it. All the patient has to do is point to the shape that they see, so they don't have to communicate verbally at all. If any of these is difficult for them, then we use another method known as preferential looking. So preferential looking, I don't know if any of you have heard of it before, but it's based on the, it works on the basis that the patient will always look at something that's more interesting. So for example, with the teller acuity cards, which are these cards over here, so what they are, they're just like a long cardboard, and on one side you have these very high contrast stripes. And when we show the patient these the cardboard, they're always going to look towards the side that has their stripes because it's more interesting for them to look at. And then it gets more and more difficult, so the stripes will become more and more dense, and then till the point where the patient can no longer resolve the stripes, so they would just look like a gray square. And if that's the case, then they wouldn't prefer to look at one side over the other, and that's their threshold for visual acuity. Similarly, with the Cardiff cards, it's just presenting with pictures. It's a little faded out on this on the screen up here, but it's just pictures either up or down, and we show the card to the patient and see if they look at the upper portion of the card or the bottom to determine the visual acuity. As you can probably kind of guess, you know, if there's a lot of distraction in the room or, you know, other lightings around, the patient might not be able to fixate every single time. So there is some, benefit to, you know, doing matching or Snellen acuity. And color vision is also important, and there's multiple ways for us to test color vision during our exam. Typically, we would have the child or the patient identify the shape they see on this card. So there's like the circle and the X's. If they cannot verbally communicate, we give them a kind of like a makeup brush, and they can be the painter and just trace the shape that they see. What else? You can also see on the bottom there's colored cubes, and we can just line them up in the sequence of a rainbow, and the patient just has to, you know, copy that same sequence. Or we can also do is we can give them a beach ball and have them place it on the hoop. So that's upper two plates are the CVTME. So it's another way of testing color vision. So there's multiple ways of modifying how we can test these color vision. All right, so contrast sensitivity is the ability for somebody to distinguish the different shades of gray. So as Dr. Reuter said earlier, not everything is going to be presented with 100% contrast in our, you know, everyday world. So it's kind of like this projector slide, things are going to be washed out a little bit. It's not very in focus. So contrast sensitivity tells us how these patients are going to perform with these, optimal conditions. And it's also actually very sensitive in picking up some neurological disorders as well. So Hiding Heidi is this little, the girl's name is Heidi, and these test plates are created with reduced contrast sensitivity, so it gets dimmer and dimmer to see. What we do is we present the Hiding Heidi with a blank card and just have the patient find which card is Heidi hiding within. So up until one point when the patient can no longer distinguish the very lightly shaded color, then they cannot find where Heidi is, and that's their threshold for contrast sensitivity. Another important thing is that we know that patients perform better with high contrast material, but sometimes they may prefer to work on a completely black background versus a completely white background. A lot of our paper or books and things like that are all presented with black letters on white background. But some people actually prefer to have white letters on a completely black background. So we can check to see if they have that type of preference by doing very simple, tasks like lining up the color blocks on a black background versus a white background to see if they prefer or perform a little bit better on a black background. And then, all right, so refraction is when we test somebody's refractive error. So this is when you guys go to the eye doctor, they're going to ask you which is more clear, one or two. When you're presented with two very different choices, it's very easy for you to pick out which one is more clear. But when the two choices are, equally blurry or very close, it's very hard for people to pick out which one is more clear. So we can't really use that method. What we use is the retinoscopy, which is a subjective way of measuring their refraction, objective way of checking their refraction. All the patient has to do is sit there and look at a target at a distance. And we're going to use that retinoscopy, and it shines like a streak of light through the pupil on the upper right picture there. Based on the reflex we see from the pupil, we neutralize the reflex using different lenses, and that's how we can get a refractive error from the patient.
So this is based off anatomy. Yep. Everybody's anatomy is different, and how their lens and their cornea bend light is different. And so this is why she's saying it's objective. We don't really need the person to participate.
Yep.
And so when I'm in a setting where I'm doing a refraction and I ask a patient which one's clearer, one or two, and you're going, oh man, and your head, they both look good. And I always tell them, listen, I know where you're supposed to be. If this is why you want a person and not a machine doing it, because there is an art. There's a space where the science stops and the art starts. And the patient's shoulders will relax when the prescription's right. Kids will get a less tense face. They will smile when the prescription's right. But in general, if you guys don't know which one is clearer, I know by going in there,
yep,
and objectively measuring your eye where you should go. So I always put my patients at ease and say, if they look the same, it's probably the same, because I know where I'm going to go with that. Okay?
Yeah. And then also, a lot of patients with congenital anomalies, they tend to develop higher refractive errors, such as, far-sighted or nearsighted, as well as having a lot of astigmatism. So it's crucial for us to be able to provide them with the clearest vision they can. And then next slide. So eye alignment. We're going to talk a little bit about anatomy. So each one of our eyeball has six extraocular muscles that controls its movement so that we can look up and down, left to right. And then all 12 of those muscles has to be balanced in order for the eyes to be aligned. So if one of those muscles are not working, the eye is going to turn somewhere, and the patient's going to see double now because they're aiming at two different images. And the brain doesn't like to see two images. It's very confusing for them. And, if you imagine trying to read something with, seeing two books at the same time, it's very, very hard. One method is the Bruckner method, which is using a direct ophthalmoscope. Does everybody know what so direct ophthalmoscope, you can actually look at the retina with that as well. But we're not using it really close. Instead, we're going to stand about a meter away from the patient so that, kind of like the upper left image, you can see that the light is casted on both eyes. And what you're going to do is you're going to look through the direct ophthalmoscope and compare the reflex from both pupils. They're supposed to be bright red and equal brightness. So if one eye, for example, that upper right image over there, you can kind of see that left eye is very dim. The reflex is dimmer than the right. Then we know that eye has an eye turn. So it's this very fast and easy way of screening if there is any type of mis-eye alignment there.
But it would have to be pretty big.
Yeah. It would have to be a big angle for you. It's just a screener test.
It's just a screening. Exactly.
Yep. And then, so similarly with a Hirschberg, this one also requires, kind of practice seeing what the reflex looks like. You're going to use a pen light instead of the direct ophthalmoscope, and you're going to shine the pen light at the patient. What you're going to be looking at is two white reflex that you're going to see over here in the center of the pupil. For that right eye over there, you can kind of see the light reflex is at the middle of the pupil, which is normal. But for the left eye, the reflex is kind of come towards, it's more misaligned towards the nose, and you know that the left eye is turned out a little bit for that reflex to come to be deviated nasally. So that's another way of checking the eye alignment there. All right, cover test.
Can you guys see over my
So cover test is my favorite way of detecting any type of eye term. What's going to happen, there's two different types that we're going to talk about today, and the first is a unilateral cover test. What you're going to do is you're going to use an occluder, and you're going to cover one eye while you're looking at the other unoccluded eye to see if there's any movement. If the eye is turned out or inward, and you cover the unoccluded eye, that eye is going to pick up fixation. It's going to, you know, jump straight or jump a little bit, and you're going to see an eye movement with that. So to demonstrate that, I know there's like, so you're going to cover that eye, and you're going to be looking at the right eye to see if there's any immediate movement. And if that eye swings in, you know that right eye was sitting outward, and we call that an exotrope. So that right eye moved in, so it was sitting outward, and that's an exotrope. Before going to an alternating cover test, when there is a constant eye turn, so that eye is sitting outward all the time, this increases the risk of developing something known as amblyopia or lazy eye, because that eye gets turned out, and we'll talk a little bit about that next. So the alternating cover test is a little different. You're taking that paddle, and instead of unoccluding both eyes or either eye, you're going to just be switching between the two eyes really fast. This also tells us how big of an eye turn there is. So when you do see an eye turn during your unilateral cover test, we can use the alternating cover test to quantify how big of an eye turn it is using prisms. But what you can also do is that alternating cover test also tells us something known as a phoria. Phoria is when the patient has an abnormal eye posture. So they can either be exophoria, meaning their natural eye position sits outward a little bit, or esophoria, meaning they kind of sit inward a little bit. But these patients have the ability to control their eyes and align them on their own. But if you occlude the two eyes really quickly, when you cover one eye, that eye will deviate to its natural eye position. And when you switch it over to the other eye, the eyes will jump a little bit. Does that make sense? Okay. So to demonstrate that, you're going to take that occluder, you're going to swing it over really quick, and if the natural eye position is outward, that eye is going to jump back in to pick up fixation. And then when you switch the occluder over, that eye will come back again to pick up fixation. And this is an example of an exophoria. All right, so this is this slide kind of demonstrates the exos, eso, and hyperphoria, as I discussed earlier. So looking at these patients without occluding either eye, they're going to be aligned because the patient can align their eyes on their own. But if you occlude one eye, that eye deviates to its natural eye position, either outward, inward, etc. I think that's it for that. All right, and modified Thorington is another way, this method requires the patient to be able to tell us what they see. So what we're going to do is we use a red filter to cover one eye. So that eye is going to see the red line. And the unoccluded eye is going to see the white light. If the eyes are aligned together, the red line should go through the white light.
This is the light here.
Yeah, so for that picture over there, that yellow dot right in the middle, that represents the white light that they're supposed to see. And if the two are not aligned together, it tells the doctor that there is a misalignment, either exo, eso, et cetera. All right, binocularity. Binocularity is very important because we have two eyes and they need to work together to be a team for us to function properly. And binocularity arises when the two eyes are pointing at the same target at the same time. And because they're kind of deviated a little bit, we're going to get two very similar images to the brain. And the brain is going to be able to put those two similar images together into one picture with depth to it. And this is known as stereopsis, or your 3D vision. And stereopsis is very important for the child to develop a very precise or accurate eye-hand coordination. So if you only have one eye, there are some monocular cues around our surrounding environment to still tell certain depth to things. But without stereopsis, the patient's going to take longer to do any type of task that involves the eye-hand coordination. There's multiple ways of testing stereopsis, and typically it involves wearing polarized glasses. If the patient doesn't like to wear anything around their face, there's newer stereopsis tests, or known as the best stereo test, which they don't even need any type of polarized glasses. They can just look at the booklet and be able to tell which of the pictures is popping out or going inward, things like that. So when there is no stereopsis or reduced level of stereopsis detected during the previous test, we have to figure out a reason why. You know, why is the 3D vision reduced? Then we check something known as suppression. Kind of like I said a little bit earlier before, the brain doesn't like seeing two images. So if one if one eye is turned out over here, it's looking at the door, the brain's not going to like having this confusing two pictures together. So it's going to try to actively shut off that eye, and this is known as suppression. When there's suppression, it increases the risk of someone developing amblyopia or the lazy eye again. So what we do to test for suppression in clinic, we use the three-figure flashlight, so the girl, elephant, and the ball. We have the patient wear a red-green glasses, and the red is the filter, which will only allow red and white light through, so that the eye behind the red filter is only be able to see the girl and the ball. The green light will only allow the elephant and the ball to be seen. So in order to see all three pictures, both eyes has to be used at the same time. If one eye is turned out, looking at the door somewhere, and it's getting suppressed by the brain, it's not going to see three pictures. It's only going to see the two, and we can test which eye is getting suppressed, and that's what this is for. We can actually treat suppression in clinic using vision therapy, which Dr. Reuter will talk about next. So the bottom two pictures is just showing you a anti-suppression or like a chart with suppression checks. So one eye will only be able to pick out some letters out of that chart, and then the rest of the letters is seen by the other eye. For the patient to be able to read the chart across each line, both eyes have to be used at the same time. All right, so this image is showing you at the extreme gazes that the patient can look at. And looking at these extreme gazes will help us to isolate each of the eye muscle movement. So, like I said earlier, each eye has six muscles, and we have to determine which of those eye muscles is not working to determine, what's the possible cost to the eye turn. And this patient is just demonstrating a normal individual who can look at all nine gazes normally. And then we'll go to the next slide. So, because those eye muscles are controlled by cranial nerves, sometimes the cause of a eye turn could be because of a cranial nerve palsy. And we have to, kind of delve into that a little bit more. But when there's a cranial nerve palsy, the patient is going to see double only at certain gazes. So they're not going to see double at every single one of them. They're going to see double worse at the gaze where the muscle is working, because that muscle is not working anymore, so they're going to see two. For example, during that middle picture over there, the three picture of the little girl, when she's looking to her right side, you can kind of see both eyes are aligned pretty good. And when she looks at, the primary gaze, or looking straight ahead, her eye seems to be pretty straight aligned as well. But when she looks out to the left, you can see this left eye over here, it doesn't seem to be moving out normally. So it seems like that muscle is restricted over there. When that happens over time, this girl is going to develop a head posture. So she's going to prefer to turn her head to the left so that she can look out of her right side more, so that she can see double. Because if she's looking out of her left, her left eye can't turn out and she's going to see double. So with time, this little girl is going to develop a head posture. And similarly with the three pictures over here on the right here, you can see the two eyes on the top pictures looking up, they're pretty straight aligned. Looking straight ahead, that left eye seems to be turning in. And when the little kid is looking downward, the two eyes seems to be crossing a lot more. So over time, this child may develop a chin tuck. So the child can look through the upper portion or the upper gaze to see single all the time. There's another condition known as nystagmus. Any of you guys have seen nystagmus before? Yeah. So nystagmus is that little jumping, jiggly eye movement. When the eye is constantly moving, it's hard for them to pick out detail because the retinal image is going to be smeared. It's very hard for them to see that 20/20 visual acuity even. However, most of these nystagmus have a null point, which is a certain gaze that the amount of nystagmus is going to reduce in frequency as well as in magnitude. So these patients will like to, we prefer to look at, look towards their null point to see better. Yeah. So it depends on the condition. Sometimes those two points may be colliding to, or maybe at one gaze, but over time, kind of like I said before, with seeing double, the brain's going to shut one eye off, so it's going to suppress and won't see double. And, you know, that eye can pick out whichever null point it will prefer to look at. So,
It's like the brain will decide, would I rather see you both eyes together? Or and like have a shaky image, or would I rather suppress one eye and have a still image? You know, so the neurology will decide for that patient.
It depends, yeah.
But I would agree with you that more it's easier for the brain to shut off one eye than it is to still the world.
Yeah.
So if I would say that the vast majority of patients whose null points don't line up, like their centration point for strabismus is what it's called, but for lack of so if they're the point where they're aligned and the point where the world is more still don't line up. The brain is going to be able to suppress one eye easier than it would be to make those eyes work together at the still point. So you're going to probably more often see a person who's suppressing one eye and that has a head posture towards the null point of the segment. Does that answer it?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So moving on. There's additional tests that we also test during a comprehensive as well as developmental disability evaluation. And near point of convergence is the ability for someone to cross their eyes a little bit. So whenever we're reading or looking up close, our eyes actually have to cross just slightly to see the target single up close. And if the patient doesn't have the ability or the normal ability to cross their eyes effectively, whenever they're reading up close, they're going to see two because, you know, naturally our eyes kind of sit straight ahead. So when they come together, they're going to see two. So what we do is we show them a target and just have them try to cross their eyes as much as they can. If they don't have that ability, then that's also known as having convergence insufficiency, as some of you might have heard of it before. Pursuit eye movement is ability for an eye to move, to follow a moving target. And this is very important in athletes because whenever they're looking at a ball, they have to be able to look at a moving target accurately and smoothly to be able to react to it in time. Saccades is the eye movement where the eyes are going to jump from one target to the other and back and forth. And this is very important whenever we're reading. When we're reading, our eyes are actually not smoothly moving across the page, but we're jumping from word to word. And if the patient doesn't have an accurate or proper saccadic eye movement, they're going to lose their place whenever they're reading, and they might be repeating the same line over and over or skipping lines whenever they read. So these are also important tests, or tests that we also perform on our patients as well. Next, we're going to talk about eye focusing, which is also known as accommodation. So the ability for us to focus and see clearly at near. Naturally, when we get a little bit older, our eye focusing reduces. So that's when we start to need reading glasses or bifocal to help us see clearly at near. So for children, there's a normative data available for each different age. And if the child doesn't have, or a patient doesn't have the ability to focus at near, whenever they're reading, it's going to be blurry. And because in a classroom setting, they're going to be looking up close and far away to, you know, copy something very fast. And if they can't transition their focusing system back and forth, it can also, be very difficult for them to learn and copy things at school. So to test this, we use a target, we bring it really close, and then have the patient tell us whenever they can see it clearly. So if you press the right button, so that target goes away, and we measure how far does it take for the patient to be able to clear that target. And there's other ways of testing it as well. All right, so diagnosis-wise, these are some of the very common diagnoses that we usually get. So convergence insufficiency, meaning the inability to cross your eyes effectively. Convergence excess, meaning crossing your eyes too much. You can also see double and get headaches and things like that if you're crossing too much. Accommodative insufficiency is the inability to have, or the reduced ability to focus your eyes up close. And, you know, similarly, you can also focus too hard, too much over the plane where you're reading, and things will still get blurry as well. Ocular motor dysfunction, or the kind of to the pursuit and the saccadic eye movement, where the eyes cannot follow a target or jump from one target to the other smoothly and effectively, or strabismus, having an eye turn. All right, and then so all of those diagnoses are testing how effectively can we get the visual information to the brain. It doesn't really test for how we actually process all of those information. So here's a list of areas that we also look at to see how does a patient actually, what do they do with that information? For example, discrimination is telling the difference between very slightly, very similar images. And laterality, directionality is very important when the child is learning or the patient is learning about their letters, all the B's and the D's and the P's and Q's, you know, when they have a circle and a stem going somewhere. So they have to be able to know their left or right to have, to not have reversals. So that's all of the other visual information process that we also look at in our patients as well. I think there are anything else to add?
Am I up next?
Yes.
I mean, there's so much we could add on everything.
Yeah.
That's the problem, you know. So visual information processing is so big, you know. Figure ground, being able to pick something out of, you know, picking out pertinent information off of a red page or in a crowd, or when she's talking about smooth pursuit, an athlete following a ball, it's the same thing as saying, hey, kid, find your mom or track your mom through the movement of this crowd. Make sure she gets to the lemonade stand. That's a pursuit. He has to follow his mom through a crowd. But he would also have to use figure foreground to be able to pick out visually important information and filter out visually unimportant information. People with disabilities, whether it's acquired or congenital, have a filtering issue. It's very hard to filter out information that's not important from information that is important. And so they have almost sensory overload, and they don't, you see a withdrawal. They don't, it's almost like it's too much, and so they're just going to opt out. They're deciding not to take part. And I see some people nodding their heads. I mean, we do that ourselves, you know. So in all of these, we could go into talking about each one of them for a whole lecture. I mean, kids take 4 years of school for these things. But yes, overall, first part was getting information to the brain. The visual information processing tests are deciding or figuring out if the person is using that information properly.
Yep.
The good thing about all of this stuff.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, here.
Oh, yeah.
This is your last slide.
And then, so after each of our evaluation, we're going to generate a report for our patient. And within that report, it's going to talk about all of the different areas. So visual function or is a patient getting the information into the brain? Are their eyes healthy? Are their two eyes working together? And all the way until, visual information processing. How are they dealing or what are they doing with these information that they're getting to their brains, et cetera. So, from those evaluation, we also put recommendations. What can we modify in their everyday classroom setting? You know, if they have a null point, then maybe this child needs to be seated at a different area of the classroom so that they can have, you know, so that they can be looking through their null point, things like that. So we'll put recommendations in the letter for each patient as well. Yeah.
Treatment recommendations too.
Yeah, and also, of course, treatment. So whether we're prescribing glasses, we're doing prisms, we're vision therapy, and et cetera. So there's tons of stuff that we can talk about treatment. So next, Dr. Reuter is going to talk about the different treatments that we're going to, that we can provide for the patient as well.
Okay, so, you know, when we're looking at this slide, I'm kind of going to go through it sort of like this. So we always want to ask ourselves, is there a glasses prescription that could help this patient? And you know, we keep saying child, but it doesn't. Vision therapy is for everybody. I mean, I went through vision therapy. The only reason I'm an eye doctor today is because I started getting headaches when I was a senior in college, and my mom's a psychologist, so she's in that, like, weird doctor's loop, you know, that, like, out of the box. And she's like, maybe it's your eyes. And I said what everyone says, like, I'm 20/20. That's your crazy woman. And, of course, you know, I was 20, right? So, like, your mom's always wrong at that age, too. And so she's like, just go get your eyes examined from a functional developmental optometrist. And I ended up having, you know, a convergence excess issue and went through vision training myself, and it changed my life. And I was, you know, at a top 50 school as a biochemistry major. So, like, I had suffered through it. I had pushed through it. But, I mean, there are people who don't get that far that could have gotten that far. And that's kind of what we're here. We want to make sure that people aren't not living up to their genetic aptitude because their eyes are getting in the way. But, so the first step is, sort of like, is there a prescription that will help this person function better? So a lot of people say see better, and I disagree with that. Sometimes if you would correct a person down to 20/20, then their eyes are going to get more in the way of each other. And so what I always do is I prescribe the best refraction for binocularity. It's for my end goal, right? If the person has only one eye and the other eye is not functional, it's blind or whatever, then of course, then I'm gonna refract for clarity. But I always want to give a functional prescription. So you can choose in whatever way you're going to measure that. You could do a refraction and test their stereopsis over again, or do a refraction and let them walk through the room or catch a ball with you. But whatever helps them function better is what I'm going to prescribe, because I want this kid functioning better. I don't need them seeing a teeny little target while they're still in it still. Really, what they need to see is 20/30 or, 20/30, 20/40 to be successful in the classroom. They don't need to see 20/15 to be successful in the classroom. Now, if their 20/15 prescription gets them also functioning optimally, great. That's an easy layup, right? That's an easy prescription. But I'm always going to check how the kid is functioning through that prescription that I am thinking about, okay? So the refractive error, there's a lot of studies coming out that refractive error can be reactive. So, like, it's an adaptation to improper binocularity. So if the kid has a hard time teaming their eyes, then one eye can become a certain prescription just so the brain has an easier time shutting it off. And so we want to make sure that I'm not just going and looking at this kid and saying, oh, you have a -5 in one eye and a +2 in the other. Here's the prescription. I need to say to myself, well, why is the neurology choosing that prescription? Because I can guarantee you that they weren't born with that. So that's another reason for going to a person who's thinking about these patients in a functional way, because, again, that's why we're here. We all want to function better, I'm pretty sure. Okay. So then, you can go to the next. So that, we're going to add, we're going to give a prescription, and then sometimes we need more prescription to read with. Okay, and that's just going to help. It can help many things. It can help clarity, and it can help the way that the eyes are being used together. So oftentimes you'll see kids come in with a bifocal. We set them pretty high, the line, because if not, they'll just look over the top of it, and they won't use it anymore. They're really good at, knowing how to not do it, I have 3. 2 of them are under 2, and I know all about kids. They're just really smart. They will figure it out. So we set it pretty high. The other thing we can do is use prisms, and that sort of speaks to your question before about null points with strabismus, with eye turns and nystagmus, is that if those two points don't line up, and this is, most patients don't have strabismus with nystagmus, but just to speak to that question before, if those two null points didn't line up and it was before the brain learned to suppress, we could use a prism. Prism moves the image to wherever the eye. It doesn't move the eye, it moves the image. So if that eye is out, we want to move the image out to that eye, and so that then that eye can superimpose with the other eye and sort of work together again. Okay, so we can use prisms.
Question.
Are all these short-term, so a prism lens, is it something you expect that would correct the
good
image
question,
and then eventually a person could be weaned from it?
No, it's a good question. It's so funny because we have all these debates about vernacular in our I'm sure everybody does in their respective professions, and so often, ophthalmology, optometry call these things corrective lenses. And they're not corrective. You're not correcting. They're compensatory. You're helping the patient, even a plus or a minus glass. Like, I take this off, I'm still nearsighted, right? So it's a compensatory lens. Prism is tricky because patients tend to, we call it eat it up. So the brain tends to, figure it out again. The brain is very smart. And then the patient could stand to need more and more and more. And the more adaptable the neurology is, the the more they're going to eat up that prism. And oftentimes, I use that in my diagnosis to decide if this is going to be a successful vision therapy patient. So if I throw on a prism, and I have the patient read with it for like 15 minutes, and then I go and measure the turn again, and it's more, they need more prism, then that's a positive prognostic indicator for if they would be successful in vision therapy, because that means their neurology is open to change. And in vision therapy, it's all about neuroplasticity. The beautiful part of all this neurology that's coming out is it's just proving what we've been doing for 50 years under a lot of he and ha from other professions about, well, you don't know that this is true. This is what we see in clinic. Now all the new neurology coming out is just proving it. So, which is great. But the neuroplasticity is what we're doing. We're basically just taking pathways that are faulty and either deciding why they're faulty. If they're faulty because they're using wrong pathways, then we can think of that as a road. Then we can create a new road. And at first that road is sort of bumpy, gravelly, but the more that we do it and the more that we reinforce it, then that road becomes paved. And the more that we do it and the more that we enforce it, now it's a highway. And then the more that we do it, now it's a super highway, and then it becomes automatic. And once it's automatic, the brain does not have to put energy into it, and there you go. Now an energy and attention is freed up. So I always say attention is a limited commodity resource. The brain doesn't have unlimited amounts of attention. And most of what we're attending to is completely subconscious. So the kid doesn't know, oh, I have to really work hard to keep this clear. I don't know that. But the brain does, and it gets tired, and it just will forget it, or it will work harder. You give one kid a big bucket of water with a spoon with a hole in it, and you'll have one kid that will just scoop so fast, and then finally, it'll take them longer, but they will get the water from one bucket to another bucket, okay, even though it's ridiculous. There's a hole in the spoon. Then you'll have another kid that starts scooping, will see the hole in the spoon and be like, forget this, I am not doing this. This is an exercise in futility? No. And that's what happens with binocular vision disorders. You have some kids that just muscle through. That was me. I just muscled through. I didn't know that, you know, I was over-focusing my eyes and all of it. I would fall asleep every time I read, and I would just muscle through, more coffee, whatever. And so I muscled through, but a lot of kids don't do that, and they just say, forget it, I'm not doing it.
So the muscling through, is that kind of like an example of how my son essentially seems to be the same functional vision-wise with his glasses on compared to with them off, because with them off, he's kind of muscling through?
So when I say muscle through, I mean persevere. I'm maybe not using the right. So just like, you know, if you're an athlete, someone says, oh, I don't care, get out there and still play even though your ankle hurts. I don't mean that they're using extra muscle capabilities to do it, depending on the diagnosis. And that's one thing I did want to touch on, that Dr. Hahn was saying, that all of these things, they're neurological. It's not, does that mean I have 5 minutes? Oh my gosh. Okay, it's not muscular. We're not training the muscles. The eye muscles are so strong, and if you want proof of that, ask a kid to close their eyes as hard as they can, and you're going to pry their eyelids open. You will not, and I know, you will not get a drop in that kid's eye. They are so strong. It's not about strength. It's about how well the brain is sending impulses to those muscles. Okay, so that's why I talk about neuroplasticity and training those things in therapy, because we are wanting to improve the impulses or the circuitry or the wiring to those muscles. Why your son, if the glasses don't seem to help and he's still doing whatever he's doing visually with and without, then yeah, the glasses aren't, that's not the answer.
So that's been the most important thing, that his eyes are straighter and he doesn't tilt his head so far back.
But I would say, is that serving him? So yes, you don't want to have a cervical spine issue. But sometimes just straightening out the text or straightening out the head, there was a reason in the beginning that his head was turning. So I would want to know why. Why did he have a head turn in the first place? Because, again, that speaks to that prescription thing where maybe just correcting the vision will, I mean, correct it, giving the prescription for the refractive error might make him clearer or make his head turn, but it doesn't, it's straighter, but it doesn't speak to the reason that his head was turning in the first place. So I guess I would just, if he was putting the glasses on and everything was awesome and there weren't signs anymore that his eyes were failing him, then I'd say, good. But it looks like from your face, and what I'm reading from you is that the glasses, like, they straighten things out, but there's still stuff going on.
He's got, like, a little binocular vision. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, it blurs out what he can take care of at what point, like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, whichever ophthalmologist you talk to, depending on what their focus is, it's going to change as far as what they...
Does he have an eye turn? He has strabismus?
He has strabismus, he has nystagmus, he also has atrophy and hyperplasia.
Okay. Okay.
And then a refractive
error. Okay. Well, yeah. You're going to have a refractive error again. Again, it's the brain's way of, like, trying to decide how to not take in so much information, because the information in his case is conflicting. There's just a lot going on there. So, yeah, it's not your job to know. I mean, he's like, I don't know which one to treat first. It's not your job, and that's the hard part from a parent's perspective is you don't know. And ophthalmology doesn't do great with functional stuff. They're very structure-driven, and we need structure. We need to make sure the eye is healthy. But when we're talking about function, they're not always going to be the best ones to talk to. So I would get a couple different consults. Okay?
What about the ophthalmologist? You mentioned, like, so if, just let's say a parent was in the mentioning school, or a child is having foot learning difficulties at school, and they're there, and they correct the refractive error, let's say, oh, this, you know, there's nothing else. Why don't more of an ophthalmologist direct? I know there aren't a lot of them in there, but I think there's like two in my area.
Yeah, you know, we talk about this all the time. I don't know. I don't know if it's because it's like a turf war. I really don't know. You have really great. I have people ophthalmology that refers to me. They're usually the avant-garde, forward-thinking. You got to get somebody who is into integrative medicine. The Northeast is very hard. Massachusetts especially. It's steeped in tradition. It's like old white man medicine. You know, I'm sorry to say it, but it's like nobody wants to think outside of the box, and so. You know, I found that coming up here, it's much harder dealing with ophthalmology than it is. You have, as you go west, there's more and more ophthalmologists that will not operate on a kid's eyes unless they go to a developmental optometrist first and do vision therapy first, because unless you teach the neurology to work together, I don't care how straight you make those eyes in surgery, they're going to turn again because the neurology doesn't speak to each other. And so I get frustrated too, because the science is there and there's many, many, many people who aren't looking at the science, but again, you have good ophthalmologists that are, and you have, you know, some that are coming out of Johns Hopkins saying that this matters and that this works, but for the vast majority, ophthalmology will say what we do is voodoo. And, you know, you just have to show the parents that it's not. And it, trust me, it's something that we talk about a lot.
And that's the frustration, yeah, I don't think anyone else has that experience, but, yeah. So this is, you know, a candidate
one thing I will point out about ophthalmology, and we need them, and I don't want to cause any sort of rift. They go to medical school, they take maybe one half of a class on the eye, and then everything that they learn is from a structural standpoint in residency and fellowship. They don't learn anything on the didactic academic part of the eye, where our first 2 years for us is medical, but then the rest of our training is all eye, and we have time to learn about visual function. They don't have one class on visual function. So, but that's not easy. That's not an easy pill for them to swallow because they're an MD, and like they should know everything, right? So that part is, I just want to point that out from a schooling perspective, they're basically apprentices. They go and they learn about the whole body, and then they do an apprenticeship, a residency in the eye, and that's how they learn. And they're really, they're surgeons. So they're really structure driven, and they're brilliant with structure, but their function is not, actually very few MDs deal with function. That's why you have PT, that's why you have audiologists, that's why you have all these other doctorate professions that are there to augment the MD, because they really are structure driven. Does that help? It's very frustrating, because I see kids all the time, you know, if you do a strabismus surgery, they need 2, 3, 4, surgeries, and they keep turning because it's not a muscle problem. You're operating on something that isn't a muscle problem, and it's shameful, and I think it's child abuse, but insurance covers it, so that's what we do. And so, trust me, this could be a whole nother advocacy lecture, but I feel bad for the kid. If you're in it for the right reasons, you feel bad for the kid. You feel bad for the patient. And I just want to tell the parent, just give me like 6 months with your kid before you decide to go in and chop the muscles all up. Right? So But I hear you. As I hear you.
Last question, does the insurance pay for visual therapy?
It depends on your insurance.
Okay.
And it depends on
diagnosis.
But even the diagnosis, like, so convergence insufficiency is the most covered. But even that, it's like they'll cover it after you give 3 months of home therapy, you know, with pencil push-ups. The kid's basically just doing this. Okay, well, how many times has the kid already done that, you know? But then they won't cover it, or they'll cover it like 30%, you know? And so it depends on your, and how much your employer, like how comprehensive their, so that's why it's nice at the university, we just see anybody.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons I was so enticing for me to take the job, because up until now, vision therapy's kind of been like a wealthy person's medicine, which I have a real problem with. And so that's what's nice about the university, because the private practice VT is, we basically just can't afford to take the vision insurance. I couldn't afford to turn my lights on in my private practice if I took, Medicaid covers VT, but they give me $14 for an hour. If I'm a good employer, my vision therapist makes a ton more than that, so I'm losing money, but Medicaid kids are who I want to see. So, you know, it's a real issue. So what I do private practice-wise is I give the letter of medical necessity. I give all of the medical codes. The patient pays me, but I will submit to their insurance company for them, and the insurance company reimburses them if they will, like your dentist. And patients are getting very used to that now in the advent of all this crappy medical care we're getting and crappy insurance. So you pay the doctors, and then you get reimbursed if you do. But people are getting more used to it, and it's sad. Public school is a whole other ball of wax, you know? To our school?
Yeah,
they would. It's just in Worcester, so like for a lot of people, that's not close. But yeah, you would come, and so that's kind of why we went into this whole thing. You come and get a comprehensive eye exam first. Again, this is not like a rip on any other doctor, but I like to do my own refractions because I refract differently than everybody else. But you know, they come in, they get a full, and we have to make sure. Again, we're structured people too. We need to make sure the eye is healthy. But then we take it a step further and look at function.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's deemed that they have a binocular vision problem or something that we can help them with in the therapy room, then we will suggest vision therapy. Okay? But it's like a couple-step process. And then it's done on a sliding fee scale. So, like, whatever that family can afford, that's what they pay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious a little bit about the neuroplasticity part of it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research out there right now. Thinking more of a developmental eye issue versus trauma-related one, are you finding any optimal time to do it? Do it before this age? Are you finding you can still get results with adults?
Yeah, I mean, I think the oldest person to have achieved stereopsis after not having it was like 95 years old. They just published a paper on it. Now, with neuroplasticity, the tricky part, and again, this is a slide somewhere in here, the patient has to be motivated.
Mm-hmm.
The right part of the nervous system has to be activated for the right neurotransmitters to participate in neurogenesis. So if you have an unmotivated kid, you're not going to get a bunch. But that's my job, is to come up with a plan. That's why doling out to teachers, here are some things you can do from a vision therapy perspective. It's not going to work, because we have 1,000 ways to treat a saccadic problem, and there's a reason for that, because you need that to keep the patient motivated. And then you can get real brain changes. But if you're just doing plug and play, you're not going to get real brain changes. So you're pulling up neuroplasticity because, yes, the buzz has been around TBI, but it doesn't need to have trauma. If you have a faulty wiring, you can, without trauma, rewire the brain. It's just all about connections and changing them.
I just didn't know if you're finding somebody that's been doing it one way for 37 years, and then all of a sudden...
It's longer.
Yeah, it takes...
But a lot of times, those patients are more motivated.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're more mature, and so they'll go home and do their home therapy. And
mm-hmm.
even though it takes longer, if all variables were the same, like they went home and argued with their parent about vision therapy at home, and they didn't do their vision, you know, it would take longer. But those patients tend to be super motivated,
yep.
And I find they get really awesome results with the older, 37, not older, but you know what I mean, older. Well, shame me, 37. Yeah, I know it's time. The rest of it is basically just going through different procedures for vision therapy, which you probably are all familiar with. the main points I touched on, I wanted to touch on, I did, which is we're changing brains. We're not changing muscles. It can be done at any age. It's very, very important to keep the patient engaged. But basically everything that Dr. Hahn went over that we test, that was what I was going to say. The good news is that we can train, and it helps the patient function much better.
How often do they come in for the training?
It depends. I mean, a lot of people, in an ideal world, I'd see a kid, you know, 20 minutes three times a week. But that's hard. So what we do at the university is once a week for an hour, because most parents have a lot of stuff that they're doing. If I'm doing sports vision training, I have them come in 20 minutes three times a week because the athletes, you know, they don't want to do stuff at home or whatever. But it just depends on the patient. Generic answer, 45 minutes to an hour once a week. Not usually, unless they have a functional problem that makes them hard communicators too. That can be tricky because, you know, they can't tell me when they see double, or they can't tell me when the line doesn't go through the light and things like that. But usually, if you see enough of them, you can figure it out. If anyone wants to get up and leave, I don't think you're rude, okay? But I'll stand here and answer questions until you need me to.
You're welcome.